This is Imperium Cost 666.
Today, Mike and I are joined by Anatoly Karlin, a Russian nationalist, someone who hangs out a lot on English-speaking internet, so he's kind of one of the few Russian nationalists that are available to people like us that mixes in our circles online, a friend of, I guess you could say, Anglospherical dissidents. So it's a pleasure to have him on the show. He has a Substack. He used to blog for the UNS Review back in the day. He's just kind of like a well-known writer, blogger in our spheres, friend of many other people in the scene. And obviously, he's been kind of doing the rounds on various podcasts lately, kind of discussing the war in Ukraine, because naturally, as a Russian patriot, he's obviously very kind of concerned with it and following the news very closely. So we thought it would be great to get him on and get his take, because you know, it's rare to have access to Russians in this kind of way, to be able to get their perspective and take, not only on the war, but I guess in general on Russian politics. Because lately, and his I did post on my Telegram a couple weeks ago his piece in the UNS Review when he was still writing for them about what he called Putin's or Russia's nationalist turn, which was quite interesting. Basically, the way that it kind of broke down the political categories in Russia, which are very counterintuitive to Westerners. The whole political spectrum in Russia is completely different. It's just categorically different to how it is in the West. And it's very interesting. Obviously, with the war in Ukraine, Russian politics is kind of more interesting to me at the moment. So hopefully we can get into more of that as we go on. But I'm kind of keen to kind of get your take, Anatoly, to start off. Because, I mean, I generally am sympathetic to the Russians in this war. Obviously, as a Western dissident, that's going to be where my sympathies are going to lie. But I've seen a lot of coping, in my view, from the pro-Russian side that, you know, the first month went to plan and it was just a feint on Kiev or something. And this is all what the Russians were trying to do the whole time. And to me, this is quite ridiculous. I mean, I think it has to be acknowledged, in my opinion, that the first phase of the war didn't go all to plan. That doesn't mean the Russians are going to lose the war. I think ultimately they could still win the war, but I think it might just be a longer and more difficult task for them now. And I've seen other people also claiming that, basically the Russians just want to take the Donbass and get some agreement from the Ukrainians that they're not going to join NATO, and then they can go home. Again, I don't think that's correct. I think they have maximalist aims. I think they've already rolled the dice. They're already all in, and they have to get a lot more than just that for this all to be worthwhile. So, I mean, I've seen you give the take at the beginning. You thought they had maximalist aims. You seem to think that they were going for the quick victory. And so it seems like maybe you share a similar view to myself, but I'm interested to get your take on how do you think the first month of the war has gone for the Russians? You know, what worked, what didn't work, and where to from here? Do you expect like them to go for a full mobilization and try and get more forces in to take over the country? Like, what do you think the ultimate objective is? You know, and what would you consider the difference between ultimately a victory and a Pyrrhic victory or a loss essentially in the war? Like, where would you draw the line in terms of like the final outcome?
So the first thing I will point out is that I'm not one of the people coping about with the retreat from Kiev. I mean, it was pretty obvious that the initial assumption seems to have been that that the Ukrainians would fold very quickly. Although I have a lot of questions, obviously, about back when I was making those projections that the campaign would be pretty quick, the idea that the Ukrainians would fold quickly was frankly close to like a mainstream view, in fact, I would say. That's the first thing. And the second thing is, though, that there were some, like, let's say, bizarre decisions, such as the decision not to employ all of Russia's firepower capabilities from the start. So, I mean, I would say that the aircraft sorties, for instance, that only flying at around 10% of their maximum theoretical intensity. So, and if you look at strategic bombings, such as of railway junctions, and oil refineries, you know, these sorts of things that keep an army supplied and mobile on the field. Russia has only really started doing that in the past week or so. So again, why it took them so long for to get going like this, I don't really have any good answers for that. That's presumably a question better addressed to the general staff. But otherwise, yes, I mean, I agree. I mean, it was pretty clear already several weeks ago that it's not going to take weeks. It's going to take several months. Possibly the war will be going on late this year, possibly even early next year. So it is going to be a long campaign. What I do agree with is that Russia is, in poker terms, pot committed, in that it doesn't really have a choice. Well, I mean, it does have a choice, obviously, but if it sort of calls off the military campaign without any decisive military victories, it will be objectively and accurately considered to be a defeat. And again, my position from the start is that Putin would not survive an event like that, at least not past the next elections in 2024. I don't think that the idea that there's going to be some settlement soon is realistic. I've said from the very start that negotiations are a charade from both sides, essentially, because war fever is very high in both Russia and Ukraine. And again, as I said, it's not politically feasible for Russia to call off the war unless there's a victory. And pretty much the same considerations actually apply to Ukraine for that matter. It's mutual in that respect. And as regards victory conditions, I think that the minimal one for it to be considered worthwhile would be the territories of Novorossiya, which are the eight oblasts of eastern and southern Ukraine. So that's essentially Kherson, which Russia already has all of the DNR and the LNR, those state formations in the east. Plus Zaporozhye, Nikolaev, Odessa, and Kharkov. This would probably be the minimal, acceptable thing for it to be widely considered a victory. I mean, if it goes very badly, I mean, I suppose that Russia could settle for just the Donbass plus the Crimean corridor. I'm not excluded. Probably likely than not, frankly, is that once the Donbass pockets have been surrounded and reduced, which will probably take another month or two, then there will be attacks at least all the way up to the Dnieper, I would imagine.
I think what you mentioned there about Novorossiya is something. It would be good to pause over that and kind of unpack that a little bit for the guys listening, because it's not a well-known term in the West. So I mean, Putin gave a question and answer session this year where he started making reference to that. This is the first I had heard of it, and it's basically like a huge chunk of territory that Russia bit off from the Ottoman Empire in the 18th century, and it basically includes like Crimea plus like about a third, like the eastern third of Ukraine, as far as I understand. Correct me if I'm wrong, anything I'm saying here. But anyway, it was clear during the session that Putin sort of intended to control this Novorossiya, and that Russia regards it as its rightful territory. And it's understandable because, I mean, most of the people here are ethnically Russian. And if it does somehow kind of like affect a kind of reconquista here, it would be like a massive blow to Ukraine and the West more generally. So, and like the Ukrainian population would be about cut in half, lose about two thirds of its GDP. So it does want, like Russia does want to sort of reestablish something of its empire, right? One of the takes that kind of was going around a little while ago is that Russia doesn't have any imperial ambitions, and this was sort of a point of debate between the pro and anti-Russian sort of sides here, but it kind of comes down to neutralizing Ukraine, demilitarizing Ukraine, and ultimately this idea of denazification of Ukraine. I mean, for us in the West, Nazi means something different than it does in Russia, right? Like, I mean, it still means National Socialist in Russia, but National Socialism means something very different in Russia. Like for the West, National Socialism basically means like in more than just like mid-century German or even racist or whatever. It's specifically for us, it means anti-Semitic. And this is like the cardinal sin in modernity, right? But for us, like the main victim perpetrator complex in World War II is like the Germans and the Jews. But as far as I understand, it's not how it's viewed in Russia or even like in Eastern Europe for that matter. For Slavs and Russians, the Nazis were first and foremost anti-Slavic. For the Russians, World War II is basically a conflict mostly between the German and the Slav, where like the former, like the German wants to genocide the Slav, right? And the Jews almost don't enter into it, as far as I understand. And of course, like for the Russians, the center of Slavdom is Russia, the historic protector of the Slavic peoples. So like when Putin starts talking about denazifying Ukraine, he's talking about something quite different than what that means here. He means stripping Ukraine of any sort of anti-Russian militarism. And by definition, by this definition, like the West and NATO are as much Nazis as the Third Reich are. And Joel, you posted something interesting about in your Telegram channel like a few days ago, basically sort of, I forget where it came from, but basically the upshot of it was that the goal is de-Ukrainianization and that this is tied in with denazification. So I think that's something important for our guys to kind of understand is the way that it's viewed in Russia is very different from the way it's viewed in the West.
Yeah, I mean, one more thing I would add to that analysis is that there's a large element of cosplay to it. And you use the tools that you have at hand and like the anti-Nazi struggle is obviously a big sort of rhetorical issue in Russia, which you can use to support to drum up support for the war. But I mean, Putin and the best editions of radical centrism also said that in his speech on the 22nd of February that you want the decommunization. We'll be happy to decommunize you, but fully. He tossed that out for Russian nationalists. So it's really sort of like mixing and matching to appeal to the to all the ideological corners, essentially. Anti-Nazi rhetoric for the boomers and the communist activists and the decommunization for the Russian nationalists, on the other hand. So it's sort of like a meeting of opposites in that respect. I wouldn't read too much ideologically. I did too much ideology into this rhetoric, quite frankly. More specifically, I think why Russia invaded Ukraine is firstly it's basically ethno-nationalism, so big ethno-nationalism. Yes, imperialism to some extent. I mean, there's some intersection there. But at the end of the day, many Russians, including Putin, consider Russians, Ukrainians, and Belarusians, so white Russians. Ukrainians were called Malodosy a century ago, so little Russians. Ukraine comes from the term Ukraina, so a borderland, essentially the borderland of what? Well, of Russia. There's this widespread perception that we are one big people, in a poll, even 41% of Ukrainians, as late as late last year, agreed with that assessment. So it's not exactly a fringe view, even within Ukraine itself.
Yeah, I should just clarify that.
This is the ideological foundation of it, I think the most important one. But obviously, the more proximate factors include the ones which have already been very much discussed across even in the Western media, such as NATO expansion and Ukraine's Maidanists project to transform Ukraine into a sort of an anti-Russian project. It wasn't something that was done exactly democratically, because you had pro-Russian politicians being arrested, pro-Russian media being shut down, Russian language schooling getting phased out a couple of years ago. So it's not as if it's some sort of like Manichaean confrontation between the forces of democracy and autocracy either.
So I wanted to get more into this notion of Russia's maximalist aims, because, and how you perceive this, because my impression is, I guess, yeah, like you said, basically, if they take the whole South Coast and, you know, the Donbass regions in the Far East or whatever of the country, so this could maybe be like a minimal victory condition. And yeah, I can kind of see your argument there, but surely the aim has to be larger than this, considering the amount of cost that, you know, waging this war is. They kind of have to go for taking as much as possible. I think they have to, at least in my estimation, at least try and go all the way up to the Dnieper River, so they can put that river between them and whatever remains of quote-unquote Ukraine at the end of it. But like they if they can even take the entire country foul and swoop, I mean, why not take as much as possible, considering the fact that, like, once the war ends, whatever remains of Ukraine is going to get rebuilt by the West and is probably going to get integrated into the kind of Western architecture. So it's kind of like you take as much as you can, because the rest of it is going to the enemy, right? So a lot of people have talked about the, you know, Putin's use of the term demilitarization, as though people have said things like, well, the Russians aren't going to be like the Americans in Iraq. They aren't going to try and occupy the country. They're just going to just destroy the Ukrainian military and then leave. And that doesn't make any sense to me, because if you destroy the Ukrainian military and then leave, then again, the West comes in, rebuilds the country, just all that military equipment that's just chilling in Poland that NATO have donated billions and billions, or probably hundreds of billions of dollars worth, will just get immediately given to whatever becomes of Ukraine, and it will become this radicalized. I mean, it already was being radicalized in with this kind of anti-Russian, you know, pro-Western identity. Obviously, it's going to be even easier to kind of get that done when you take the part of Ukraine that's got the most ethnic Russians. You get rid of it, and what remains are a bunch of people that are pissed off about their country being wrecked by a war that was instigated by the Russians. So obviously, like, anti-Russian sentiment will be at all-time high, and the West is coming in with all the money, with all the weapons to rebuild the state. The West can basically do what they want with that state. It will be even more under their control than the previous iteration of Ukraine was. So that seems kind of pointless to me. It seems like there has to be an occupation at the end of this, because if the Russians want to put in a pro-Russian leadership in whatever section of Ukraine they take, they're going to need to use Russian forces to kind of secure that regime. And this, I think, leads to what denazification actually means, which Mike was already alluding to. I posted quotes from, I believe, Russian state media, but apparently they were echoed by Medvedev, who, you know, obviously is one of the most senior kind of political figures in Russia, let's say, over the last decade or so, a very close ally of Putin, the president of the United Russia Party, etc., you know, former president, former prime minister. And he said that denazification implies deukrainization, so to speak, that essentially a whole generation of children have to be born and raised in what becomes of, you know, Russian-controlled Ukraine, not as Ukrainians, essentially, but as you said yourself, that Russians see them as Russians. So they have to be raised as Russians, which would require, like, a complete re-education. You have to control the media, you have to control the education, everything, in order to be able to pull that off. So that means a commitment from the Russian side to nation building is necessary here, whatever becomes of the territory they control. I don't think it's just as simple as killing Azov battalion and neutralizing the Ukrainian military and then going home. That's just, that doesn't make any sense to me. So I'm curious, like, how you kind of see that project. And do you agree that like if the Russians are forced to mobilize to win this war and bring more manpower to the front, and they can essentially like smash their way through the Ukrainian military and kind of overturn the war, which generally from my understanding in Russian military history, generally the Russians are always very bad starters to every war. And some people say things like the Russians win by losing, in a sense, like they eventually just overpower the opponents. Obviously, this was World War II was like the most typical example of this. But, I would expect the Russians to ultimately kind of get the victory once they have to kind of throw the kitchen sink of a kind of mobilized population and basically overpower the Ukrainians with more manpower as this goes on as a result. But how do you kind of see the not just how the war is going to go, but ultimately how the peace is going to be organized afterwards, which I think is a more interesting question in some ways?
Well, I mean, we have some indications of what's going to happen in Kherson, which is on the region outside Donetsk and Lugansk, which has been fully occupied. And there's a sort of temple of the military administrations there. It's going to become a People's Republic, economic integration with Russia. So the rubles are coming online, and television stations are being tuned into Russian programs. This is presumably what is going to involve when they're joining Russia. Access to Russian markets. There was even a debt jubilee there. And as regards the extent of it, my initial prediction, which I made on the February 24th, I have a tweet to that effect, is that, in my opinion, 70% chance the aim is Novorossiya, 40% that it's all the way up to the 1939 borders, which basically includes Kiev and Zhytomyr. And perhaps a 20% chance that it's going to include all of Ukraine. Problem with the far west Ukraine is that first of all, it's going to be, if there is going to be an insurgency anyway in Ukraine, it's probably going to be concentrated in the far west, which is the only region of Ukraine which has a historical legacy of insurrection. I mean, it was never really part of Russia since the medieval period, essentially, unlike Kiev and central Ukraine. They were part of Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth and then the Austro-Hungarian Empire. So really, they diverged quite significantly. So I don't know if that will be worth the bother, essentially. But on the other hand, the population is low, so might be worth going there. But again, this is highly speculative. My probability is haven't really changed, and really the fact that the West has gone very hardcore on sanctions means that it probably doesn't really make sense to continue any pursuit of compromises and so forth. Simply because those sanctions really are extreme. So freezing half of the central bank reserves is an unprecedented move. This is the first thing. And the second thing is that another important thing is that these sanctions are not going to get removed anytime soon. Simply because no Western politician, even if Russia was going to compromise right now, no Western politician would waste political capital appeasing, going against public opinion to remove sanctions from Russia. I don't really think that's going to happen, even if a theoretical scenario that Russia was to give back Crimea or whatever. Jackson-Vanik Amendment in the U.S., which sanctioned the USSR for not letting the Jews leave. That was introduced in the 1970s, and it was only the move 20 years after the collapse of the Soviet Union, just as a like a historical note. And I think it's frankly it's going to be a similar story with these sanctions. People haven't yet realized that many people haven't yet realized that they really are here to stay for the long term, in my opinion.
Well, on the sanctions quickly before Mike speaks. Again, I just wanted to point out that in my analysis, I don't think that the sanctions from the West are there just simply because they care about Ukraine. I think provoking the situation in the Ukraine was a way for Washington to essentially impose an economic divorce between, Europe, the EU, particularly Germany and Russia. And so now that they've got the pretext for enforcing that, obviously, before this war broke out, you know, they were trying to do things like, get the Germans to, not go along with Nord Stream 2 or like abandon the project and so forth. And the Germans were basically telling them to get bent. So the Americans were kind of losing control a little bit of Europe. Europe was developing closer and closer economic relations with the Russians. And I think, like, as a fundamental heuristic, I think the Americans looked at the world situation with the rise of China and said, well, unipolarity is over, liberal hegemony, it's failed, so let's look at the world and see what we can do. We can either split it in two and divide Russia and Europe, take, Europe onto our side and combine it with, the Anglosphere and Japan, and that can be our kind of part of the world that we control, and then the Russians and the Chinese can have their access with the Iranians and stuff, and that'll be their part of the world, and we'll have Cold War II with these two spheres. Or they could just focus all their energy, like the Mearsheimer idea of just focus all their energy on the Chinese, stop caring about Europe, in which case Europe and Russia would integrate and ultimately form a kind of third bloc in the world that would kind of have independence from both Chinese and American control. And I think they looked at that and said, well, we'd rather have, if the pie can be split two ways or three ways, we'd rather split it two ways because then our slice is bigger in a sense. So I think that's really like the fundamental geopolitical calculus that motivates these sanctions, not really the poor Ukrainians. It's just a pretext, in my opinion. But anyway, I'll let Mike speak.
Yeah.
Just a quick note that, yeah, I mean, I agree with this, and I've actually been writing intermittently about the great bifurcation, as I call it, between the I term the Blue Empire and the Sinosphere since around 2019. So, yeah, I mean, I fully agree with that analysis. It's not Russia. Russia doesn't have the population or much less the GDP to credibly challenge the U.S. for global hegemony, but China does, because even if it was to attain the GDP per capita of Japan or South Korea, it would still be three times bigger than the U.S. in gross GDP terms, and the economic power is the basis of military and ultimately soft power as well, for the most part. So yes, I mean, I fully agree that the coupling, as some people are calling it, or the great bifurcation, as I started calling it a couple of years ago, this is designed precisely to let the U.S., the main hegemon, in a smaller pond, essentially. So basically comprising the core West, so the EU and some other minor vassals across the world, and essentially to be able to credibly vie for dominance with the Chinese bloc during this century.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't make a lot of sense that the U.S. would have done this in order to, for the benefit of the Ukrainian people, especially when it comes to its own geostrategic interests. Like, I mean, Ukraine means nothing to America in terms of geostrategic interest. So it doesn't really make a lot of sense that they would have basically initiated this conflict by sort of running up against, you know, into Russia's backyard. That doesn't really make any sense. But in another sense, it actually kind of does, because this basically the U.S. and European bloc kind of needed to have this fight with Russia. And ideally, it would have happened earlier. Ideally, it would have happened 5-10 years ago. But as it is, Russia has been stockpiling gold. They've seen the writing on the wall. They've been working with China on an alternative to SWIFT. They've been planning for this. And the longer that this conflict gets deferred, the worse it's going to be for the U.S. and the better position Russia's going to be in. Because like the sanctions, for example, Russia has performed admirably in the face of these sanctions. I think a lot of people in the West expected Russia to kind of knuckle under and capitulate once they got basically shut out from the West in terms of like the economic bloc. But Russia's been making its own boss moves here. Like, you know, just recently, the Russian central bank said it's going to pay a fixed price for gold. Basically, what this does, it puts a price floor under gold and pegs the ruble to gold. And now Russia kind of is in a position where if it then prices oil and gold, effectively you will get a it'll effectively destroy the petrodollar. It'll undermine that. I mean, it remains to be seen whether Russia will do that. The last ones that did that, which were basically Saddam Hussein and Muammar Gaddafi, well, we remember what happened to them. So it's put the Western powers in a bit of a bind here. And that plus the move towards integration with China, integrating their payment architecture and infrastructure, is now there's a lot of reasons for, you know, other sort of like second rate powers like India, say, to divest themselves from American infrastructure and everything, especially financial infrastructure. So basically, I think the West kind of had to go all in with these sanctions and was really hoping that they would effectively BTFO Russia. But the fact that they haven't and that they might not at all in the end has been a serious problem. So this was a conflict that needed to happen. And so in a sort of broader geostrategic sense, it did make sense for them to run up against Russia's border and to expand NATO, to basically provoke it and poke the bear into acting so that there was a justification for putting in these sanctions. But yeah, I think that the longer that this goes on, I mean, obviously, the longer the war goes on, the harder it's going to be for Putin himself. But the longer that this goes on and Russia doesn't capitulate, the more solid of a position they're going to be in.
Well, yes, I mean, it is quite ironic that the Russian economy has overperformed expectations, even as the military has underperformed them. So yes, that's one minor irony of the conflict. I think as regards Russia's sustainability, I mean, at the end of the day, it's a country of close to 150 million people with a GDP of $1.5 trillion in nominal terms and $4 trillion in purchasing power parity adjusted terms. So that would make it basically close to the equivalent of the German economy. But at the same time, also a very big energy producer, energy exporter, and also a country that produces many, if not all, of the core technologies needed to sustain a modern civilization. So, for instance, one big lacuna with Russia is that it can't produce the latest microchips, for instance. That's really only something done in Taiwan and Korea. If you talk about more basic stuff like most manufacturers or IT, so there's an equivalent of Google in Russia, that's Yandex. Facebook is Vkontakte, Telegram can replace WhatsApp and so forth. And if you're speaking of commercial aviation, well, I mean, even the Iranians who were sanctioned for 40 years, they have a functioning commercial aviation sector. And but I mean, Russia produces its own planes, like the Superjet and the MC-21, which are basically 95% made of Russian components anyway. So the I don't really see the Russian aviation sector collapsing as many Western analysts are sort of like taking Schadenfreude in wishing to happen. So yeah, I mean, I suppose my basic point is that economies of scale do matter. It's one thing to cut off a country like Cuba from the world economy, then yes, a world living standards would like plummet vastly, obviously, if you have like 10 million people. This is less true if you're a country of 80 million people like Iran. And it's much less true if you're a country of 150 million people with a German tier economy in purchasing power parity terms like Russia. There's limited things at the end of the day that you can do to torpedo an economy like that, which is capable of internally substituting most Western imports essentially. If the need arise.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's not as though this is an ideal situation though for the Russians. Like, obviously, there's some short term pain, but like you say, I mean, I do think they have great agricultural sector as well, and because of their economic relationship with China, obviously, it's a match made in heaven, really, those two economies, because Russia's producing, you know, raw materials and China is the manufacturing powerhouse of the world. So those two things fit together very well. You got a market for your exports and, you know, you can pretty much import anything you want from China. They make everything. So, I mean, as long as that relationship stays in, even if they take some, you know, some short-term pain, ultimately, you can see a way where they can kind of stabilize the ship. And as you said, like the Russians are kind of advanced in certain technologies, like particularly I note that like the American spaceships use like Russian rockets, for example, you know, which is kind of an interesting indictment of the free market economic kind of, you know, ideology that, you know, Russia has a completely state funded, state controlled, you know, military technological sector that produces those rockets, and like the vastly richer American system can't produce, you know, space rockets essentially that are anywhere near as good and have to import them from, you know, their geopolitical adversary. But anyway, I wanted to kind of get your kind of takes on the Russian political spectrum, because that's a very interesting thing to me, because not only what it says about Russia, but what it says about, I guess, politics. And, you know, because, you know, often people take this kind of like left right political spectrum in the Anglosphere that we have today as being like some kind of like absolute relativity within politics, and like plot everything on this scale of this is more right wing and this is more left wing. But like the existence of the Russian political spectrum totally mixes and mashes all of these combinations in such a way that it shows the radical contingency of this. So like my impression of the Russian political spectrum is that I was reading another Russian who was writing about this. He said, like, in the same way that in the United States, kind of the entire political spectrum kind of is kind of bent essentially around racism. You know, like the most right-wing thing that's ever happened is the Holocaust, and the second most right-wing thing that ever happened was like slavery. And then, you know, basically thinking that those things were terrible, like the more terrible you think those things were, the more left-wing you are or something. And where in Russia, instead of it being about racism, it's kind of about the Soviet Union in many ways, whereas like basically a Russian conservative not necessarily loves everything about the Soviet Union. They might also appreciate, you know, like the Imperial Russia, like in the pre-Soviet era in many ways. But they kind of have, you know, a kind of, they have a certain amount of pride in the Soviet Union, let's say, as part of their national history, as part of what makes them Russian. And then the further you get towards, I guess, what you could call the Russian left, is the more you find the Soviet Union to have been a terrible thing, and the more pro-Western you are. Soviet Union, maybe for a Russian, represents like Russia's independence from the Western project, that they emerged from World War II as the only really independent political force in the world from the kind of, you know, American liberal world order. Whereas like, you know, a Russian, a leftist, so to speak, of in Russia will think, oh, well, the liberal world order is great and we made a huge mistake not joining it. And then, but often you'll get a combination then also of nationalist types, like what we would consider like, you know, nationalists in a certain way in the West. But it's a different kind of nationalism. So like you would be a Russian nationalist that kind of like supports a big Russia. Perhaps you kind of are cool with this kind of Eurasianist kind of conception. Whereas then you'll have like kind of like pro-Western nationalists that want to break essentially Russia up, that would be opposed to war in Ukraine or something, and they want to break Russia up into like smaller, you know, ethnic units, and they consider the Federation to be like, you know, this like mixing of these like, you know, incompatible ethnicities or something. Now you can see why like this ideology in America would be like the most evil thing ever according to like, you know, the American ruling class, but in Russia they'll support it because obviously, if that was put into practice, it kind of weakens and destabilizes Russian geopolitical power. So it's kind of like a, in the same sense that Ukrainian nationalism, from a Western perspective, the West doesn't give a shit about, you know, Ukraine's, you know, right to self-determination. They just care about breaking pieces of Russia's potential sphere of influence or sphere of control off and like turning it against Moscow. So, yeah, I'm curious to kind of get your takes on how you would explain, you know, the Russian kind of political stack.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I probably you make some good points, although I don't agree with all of them exhaustively, obviously. I probably shouldn't exaggerate the extent to which the Russian Federation is this sort of like multicultural motley crew. I mean, at the end of the day, it is almost 85% ethnic Russian, according to the census. That's more than the Israeli state is Jewish. Israel is Jewish. So that's one thing to bear in mind. The second thing to bear in mind is that the early Soviet Union, at any rate, I mean, I'm not a fan of the Soviet Union at all, because I basically view the destruction of the Russian Empire as not just like politically or culturally destructive, although it was. But also, it was a massive demographic disaster. I mean, if it wasn't for the civil war, the purges, the famines, and the World War II, then according to various calculations, Russia's population would be almost twice as high today as it is now, and would obviously be in a much greater, in a much more powerful position then. And it was ultimately also the Soviet Union, which at various periods of its history, especially during the 1920s and again in the 1950s, de facto promoted local nationalisms in contradistinction to old Russian nationalism. So in Ukraine, particularly in Belarus, so those campaigns were being called Karenizatsiya. And like you had cases of in the 1920s, of essentially Russian language newspapers being shut down in places like in cities like Odessa, which is originally, frankly, if you look at its demographics in the 19th century, it was all Russian and Jewish. There were like almost no Ukrainians, Ukrainian speakers there. In that respect, I think it's a bit of an exaggeration to say that the Russian nationalists, or at least people who share this view of Russian history, which I do think includes many of the Russian elites.
So being pro-Soviet is like being pro-Soviet be like being a Russian boomer, if you will, and then your position is reactionary.
I think it's important to acknowledge that the early part of the Soviet Union, at least, was very bad for Russian nation building. I mean, frankly, it reversed Russian nation building, in its at least as it existed from the 1920s to 1950s. I mean, obviously, there were bad things about the collapse of the Soviet Union. I mean, nobody denied it. No Russian nationalists, I mean, few Russian nationalists would deny that. Obviously, because you had Russians being standard abroad in culturally foreign countries. You had the vast economic breakdown, a 40% collapse in GDP, a retreat of Russian culture across Eurasia. So that was a bad development, obviously. I mean, as regards Eurasianism per se, well, again, that's sort of like an iffy issue, because Central Asia has 70 million people. It will probably have something like 100 million people in another half a century. So I don't really think that very close integration with that region is advisable at this point. Simply because if it happens, then the Russian state becomes much less Russian, frankly. This is why somebody like Alexander Solzhenitsyn, for instance, his ideal vision was for Russia, Belarus, and Ukraine. And Kazakhstan, or at least northern Kazakhstan at any rate, which is the Russian part of the country, to unite into one Slavic superstate and to largely leave the rest of the former Soviet Union. So that's like the Caucasus and most of Central Asia to their own historical destiny.
Yeah, it's good. Like, it makes a lot of sense the way that you've framed it in terms of that the left and the right don't exactly map onto the communist versus the federation and what's happened since then, because there's a kind of continuity problem that was addressed. Like, there was constitutional reforms in, like, I think 2020 that defined ethnic Russians as the state-forming people of the Russian Federation, right? And yes. These reforms, they made reference to, like, you know, the thousand-year legacy of Russian statehood, right? Like, mm-hmm. sort of going back to this concept of nationality that's been there for centuries, like Narodnost, I think it's called, the three poles of Russian political ideology that are famously articulated by Nicholas I. And anyway, the idea of these reforms was to kind of assert a kind of continuity between the Russian Federation and the Russian Empire, to kind of deny that post-Soviet Russia was this like unhistorical thing, just kind of hanging in the ether and not connected to the deeper history of the Russian people, which, as I understand it, has been a narrative, sort of a subversive narrative that's been sort of pushed in Russia or whatever by like more subversive elements. So, I mean, there's a kind of, certainly Russia is a nationalist country. I mean, that's another sort of insane take that's kind of like going around in Western nationalist circles, some like in the sort of like anti-Russian side of that Russia is not a nationalist state. Like, it's this multi-ethnic empire that's this hodgepodge, this sort of weird thing or whatever. This is the take, right? Mm-hmm. But it's not the case. Basically, there is a Russian nationalism, and it doesn't have anything to do with like reviving the Soviet Union. Like, Putin doesn't want to do that. It would be demographically disastrous. There's like way too many Central Asians for integration to work, and it would destroy the state forming core of the Russian demographic. As you mentioned, it's about 85% of ethnic Russians. But it does have everything to do with, you know, reasserting Russia as a coherent nation that derives from common birth. And this is actually this is kind of a 4D chess move with Putin, right? Because he's basically pulling the rug out from under nationalist groups that could undermine his sovereignty. He's sort of adopting nationalism and saying, okay, now the state is now explicitly nationalist. The Ruski population is nationalist. So, like, what are these unaffiliated nationalist groups for? They're kind of redundant, right? So I think that that's actually quite a shrewd move on his part. And I think it's important to understand the sort of the difference between Ruski and Rossiyane. I'm probably butchering the pronunciation here, but it's kind of like a dichotomy that's a bit uncommon in the West. But it's not actually that uncommon in the ancient world. Basically, it distinguishes between Russians and their empire. And I should clarify, when I said that Russia was sort of becoming imperialist before, I don't mean that as a bad thing at all. It's kind of an inevitable thing. So Ruski is the term for ethnic Russians, you know, the westernized, like, Indo-European Russians, this ethnic Russians. And Rossiyane is the term for any person that sort of is part of the multi-ethnic Russia, including the Central Asians, the Siberian peoples, the Turkic peoples, and so on. So, I mean, if you want a kind of analogy here, you could think of maybe the difference between the English and the British, but even that doesn't really have the same force. It's more like how that would have been viewed in the 18th century, like when the English were considered the state-forming core and the Scottish and the Welsh were kind of like a subject people. This is kind of more the way it's viewed in Russia, I think. So, like, officially all Russians have equal rights, and there's no distinguishment based on the basis of, like, race or ethnicity, but, you know, in practice, it's like the 85% Ruski majority that's like the sovereign core. And the way I sort of view the Ukraine situation is that this isn't like they're another species of Rossiyane. That's kind of the way that it seems to be viewed. So the Russian imperial project of basically, you know, invading Ukraine and trying to turn it into part of Russia, it makes a lot more sense along these lines, which, you know, the dichotomies between left and right don't really apply to Russia. We don't really have this Ruski, Rossiyana, or anything like that analogous in the West. So it's very hard to understand the situation unless you kind of understand the terms that the native terms that are applied to it.
Well, yeah, I would largely agree with this. I mean, the one thing I would point out is that the Siyanie is a civic identity, and I mean, it's not such a big issue today, but I mean, there were some funny instances like in prior years where Russian bureaucrats made bureaucratic types went way out of their way to avoid speaking about Ruski, which is the Russian ethnic group. But one thing I would also add is that there was basically a redefinition of Ruski. Originally, if you looked at maps in, say, the 19th century, you would typically have Velika Rossa, which are like ethnic Russians today in like what is now Russia. You had Malorossa, which are now Ukrainians. And you had the Belarus, which are white Russians, so the Belarusians, which is where Belarus is today. So this is sort of like how it was in the 19th century, and there was this state ideology that they were the three branches of of one people, so the Ruski Narod. To use an analogy, I mean, I suppose you could look at Germany, say, and say that Germans who themselves include Prussians, Bavarians and so on, and Austrians, and maybe even a Dutch, according to some nationalist interpretations in the 19th century, belonging to one German people. You had this sort of state ideology of triunism, the old Russian nation, which is composed of Great Russians, Malorossa, and White Russians. And over the course of the 20th century, primarily under the Soviet Union, this ideology transmogrified into something that was called the Brotherhood of the concept of the brotherly peoples, Russians and Ukrainians, Belarusians, no longer so much one people, but merely brotherly peoples. And of course, I mean, this was, in my opinion, pretty destructive, because at the end of the day, lots of peoples could consider themselves to be brotherly with each other. And frankly, I mean, it's a term that that has largely become devaluated with overuse.
So I'm curious to get a little bit more of your analysis on, because obviously, as a Westerner, or as a kind of Anglo, let's say, the like Russia is kind of got a bit of like a mystique about it. Like it does, it's sort of something easy to kind of comprehend. Like when I look at German culture or French culture, it's very intuitive to kind of grasp how it all fits together, where there's something just a little bit different about the way the Russians do things. But I've been reading a lot of A. James Gregor's work lately, and his like analysis of basically, he does a lot of analysis of the history of fascism and Marxism, Leninism, but obviously a lot of focus on, you know, kind of particular development of the Soviet Union. And his analysis is that, you know, when you get to like the 70s and the 80s, essentially, you know, the kind of Marxist-Leninist intellectual elite, they're only really Marxist-Leninist in name. They don't actually believe in any of the core tenets of the ideology. And essentially what ends up occurring is you get like a kind of this kind of deviation, particularly in the 80s, between like two tendencies. Like one tendency is kind of, well, we should kind of keep the kind of state, like kind of like the state machinery of the Soviet Union going, but just kind of gradually kind of nudge it towards a kind of more autocratic nationalist, you know, authoritarian state, and just kind of just keep gradually kind of shedding the kind of Marxist ideological veneer. And the other attitude was obviously kind of embodied with, you know, Gorbachev and then ultimately like Yeltsin, which was, you know, we need to kind of, you know, the West write about liberalism. I need to kind of, you know, embrace something like more akin to a liberal system and look to join the West. So then this led to, you know, obviously like Zhuganov and the Russian Communist Party being kind of like Nazbol type, so to speak, if you want to use a meme word. They're very, they don't really emphasize Marxist ideology all too much, but they're more interested in like, you know, Orthodox Christianity and a kind of quasi-fascistic kind of conception, like nationalist conception of the Russian people and in a kind of authoritarian managerial state that kind of reflects that. So I'm curious as to like what you think about you know, those guys, like the kind of, because they're obviously not very electorally popular. They've kind of had their ups and downs over the years, but you know, obviously Putin is basically like unchallengeable at for the foreseeable, unless this war goes terribly wrong. So how, you know, how is that kind of perceived in Russia, that kind of like wing of politics? And how do you see, I guess, the future of the Russian state? Because I mean, obviously it's taken more of an illiberal turn, you know, so, and it's taken a more of an actively like kind of anti-Western turn, whereas in, you know, the 90s and even when Putin first came to power, there was seemingly a lot more positivity from Russian political leaders towards the West, Western political systems, and maybe a vain hope that the Russians could, you know, basically, you know, softly integrate into the West. That obviously didn't work out. So maybe like your analysis of how all those pieces fit together and, you know, ultimately Russia's relation to the West, you know, and how that kind of, and also to the development of kind of this Soviet legacy and how that all fits together into like the Russian political ideological identity.
Yes, sure. I mean, I agree. The ideas that the Soviet Union should progressively adopt its Marxist-Leninist ideological baggage. I mean, both from practical considerations that the centrally planned economy just isn't very effective, and also both from ideological ones. So based on the principle that people aren't really loyal to a system which only promises rewards in the material world, especially if that same system isn't even actually very effective at doing so. So like if you have a nationalist or a theocratic regime, then yes, I mean, it theoretically would find it much easier to power through crises simply because the ultimate values there are not material. But the socialist system was predicated on the promise of reaching material abundance and overtaking Western living standard and so on, when that was failed to be achieved year after year, there obviously appeared questions. And yeah, I mean, even Alexander Solzhenitsyn, there's a document called a letter to the leaders of the Soviet Union, where he basically proposed something along those lines. So basically, like retaining the political structure, but getting rid of the ideological baggage, essentially. And yes, unfortunately, that was not adopted. By the Soviet leaders, unsurprisingly. I mean, at the end of the day, it's the states don't exactly just go overboard their founding ideology. So I don't really think it was very realistic to expect something otherwise. Yes, after the collapse of the Soviet Union and the appearance of Russia, yes, I mean, you could very legitimately say that the modern Russian Communist Party has shed a lot of the Marxist baggage, and that it's sort of like more of a nuts ball construction in several ways. Although really, to be honest, it's that might be a good descriptor for Zhuganov, the leader. But although on the other hand, if you actually look at the KPRF, then it's got all kinds of people there. It's basically a kind of common roof for all kinds of oppositionally minded people right now. Some of them, obviously, not sort of like Nuts Bolish flavor. Others who are more of a SJW leanings. Other people who are not even communist or socialist at all, but just want to have an official structure from which to do opposition politics.
So you think it's a bit of a shit show, and that's kind of why it's not very electorally successful, and because they just don't seem serious about being a government. They're just kind of like a bunch of ideologues. And
at the end of the day, it is more or less the only the most serious opposition party. There's an element to that, frankly, it's also very populist, I'd say. There's a sort of like an amusing asymmetry in that the flumers in both the most energetic flumers and anti-vaxxers in both the U.S. and the Russia wore red caps. So like the MAGA people in the U.S. and the commies in Russia. There's also that sort of like deep populist undercurrent, I would say, within the KPRF. But again, it sort of like mixes and matches all of these people. And yes, I mean, I think that's part of the reason why it can't be too electorally successful. Another reason is also that it's planned. The banal fact that it's planned was strongest amongst boomers and the elderly, and this is a demographic that is progressively dying off because of natural demographic reasons. Basically, to some extent, its electoral decline is locked in, just by mere dint of its electorate being very old, on average.
So, do you see Russia kind of maintaining, like, United Russia basically functioning as just like perpetual dominators and a de facto one-party system, kind of continuing for the foreseeable future? I mean, with Zhukovsky, is that how you say his name? He obviously died recently. That's like the other main oppositional kind of political leader. Without him, you'd think, well, there's not really much else but the Zhuganovs, you know, commies, like, really left in Russian politics in any meaningful way.
Yeah, obviously. I mean, the KPRF will survive as Zhuganov's death, but frankly, I'm very skeptical that the LDPR will sort of last for another 5 years, because I mean, for the most part, it's basically a cult of personality around Zhirinovsky, who is a very colorful figure, and with him gone, they don't really have a task. The other big development, obviously, is that the LDPR has people with all kinds of positions in them, but the one thing holding them together is Russian nationalism. So that was for a long time the de facto Russian nationalist party. that was allowed to sort of politically operate. And now that United Russia and the Russian state essentially has adopted virtually all the demands of Russian nationalism, the LDPR doesn't really have much to do after this point. So I suppose you could make the comparison with Hungary. I mean, I don't know how familiar you are with electoral politics there, but as I understand it, Fidesz, which is Orbán's party, essentially moved right and towards like adopting many national positions, and the Jobbik, which was their main sort of nationalist party before that, they've sort of imploded after that, and some of them even joined the liberal opposition, others joined Fidesz, and others like became like really, really right wing. But essentially they fell apart more or less. I expect something similar to happen to the LDPR. I don't expect it to last for very long. There's multiple examples in the world of single party states existing for a very long time, from Japan, Liberal Democratic Party, to the People's Institutional Revolutionary Party in Mexico, to the People's Action Party in Singapore, all of them which have stayed in power for decades and end, essentially. And if the Putinist regime sort of achieves victory and solidifies its legacy in this way, then yes, it will. I don't expect any good reasons for it not to last several decades as well, including after the retirement or death of Putin himself.
Well, it wouldn't be it wouldn't be unprecedented in Russian history to have a kind of, so to speak, autocratic party in power. I mean, this is obvious given its history, that even going back to the 19th century and everything, the sort of peculiar concept of nationality, it seems peculiar to us in the West, where it's based on sort of orthodoxy, autocracy, and nationality. The sort of old school czarist notion of nationality, it seemed at the time that historically Russians kind of saw themselves as peculiarly fitted to autocracy, like there's something about the Russian people, they're fiercely loyal and obedient, and that it's sort of the unique genius of Russia that this sort of this indissoluble bond between people and sovereign, there's something kind of corporatist about that. And it wasn't even just the upper classes kind of like assigning themselves privileges either, because feudalism was much less decentralized in Russian. Like it basically the state has always been very strong in Russia going back to the medieval times. And this is kind of like the historical view of Russian nationality, at least up until the time of the Russian Revolution. But and then, of course, later on, you get a Stalin. And basically, Russia has a very long pedigree of these strong leaders. So it wouldn't surprise me. I mean, obviously, it'll be contingent upon the war. But just from an ideological perspective and from a sort of instinctual perspective almost, it seems like Russians are okay with that. They're okay with a strong state. They're okay with a strong centralized government and a leader that's charismatic and sort of figures at the head of that. So it doesn't surprise me that opposition parties have trouble getting purchase in Russian politics, because it seems like it's always sort of been that way.
Well, I mean, isn't everyone okay with that, though? I mean,
it is kind of the default state of like human nature, of course. But
I think that's how things would be if it wasn't for the mass gay-oping of the post World War II order. I mean, I don't think without American influence that considering the direction that the Portuguese or the Spanish or the Germans or even like the French under de Gaulle, you could say, took. That they would all necessarily be just these kind of libtard democracies now if it wasn't for that kind of, the kind of massive might of the American state being able to throw its weight around economically, diplomatically, in terms of security, obviously, as well, to kind of like impose this particular political form, whereas I think a one-party state, like if you kind of, you know, think about the managerial age, like if you kind of like break up, you know, if you take Burnham seriously, and you buy like the managerial revolution, then like from the perspective of, you know, basically trying to organize a modern state run by like professional, technical statesmen, having a whole bunch of, having like basically the entire government constantly getting replaced every 4 years and having these like competitive parties really kind of gets in the way of that, which is why, of course, in like the American system itself, it's really an illusion. Like the multi-party system doesn't really exist in a very serious way, and the State Department kind of continues doing what it's doing, and the Defense Department kind of continues doing what it's doing anyway, with only minor aberrations, depending on who wins the elections. So, obviously we're kind of all, you know, kind of red-pilled, I guess, in this neck of the internet, but. I think all the only reason why the Russian political form, I guess, is just more explicit, and it is just simply a function of its ability to be independent from the American-led world order. This is kind of like another question that I wanted to ask Anatoly. Exactly, it's like, how do you see Russia's relationship to the West? When I kind of talk to other kind of, you know, Anglo dissidents. Seems to be like a general respect of the Russians, a kind of sense that like Russia is like the other, they're like the edge of Europe. They're like the Europeans over there. We are the Europeans over here in like America or Australia. And we kind of have this, we're like a polarity and a kind of mutual respect that kind of comes from that. Whereas like there's, you know, a lot of, you know, the kind of a minority, I guess, in the scene, the kind of Ukrainian sympathizers, I guess you could say, who are kind of depicting Russians as being essentially like not functionally part of Europe, calling them like an Asiatic power and all this nonsense. But obviously Russia has always kind of had this, you know, exterior relationship to Europe in a sense that it's kind of gone its own way with it hasn't gone with the trends in terms of the political evolution of the West. Like the kind of imperial bureaucracy of the Tsar was kind of like a mixture between, I guess, some components of the imperial Chinese system and a European system. It didn't have like the same kind of manorial feudal order organized in the same way that you did in like France or England or whatever. And then obviously, you know, the rest of the West goes in one direction, and, you know, you have the Soviet Union in Russia. And then even today, obviously, the kind of Russian state has a kind of uniqueness. Russian politics is like unique from the rest of the West. And I would say that's just a function of the fact of geography and just its, you know, its capacity to remain independent as a result of the strength of its size. But how do you see it?
Oh, I mean, I don't have any fundamental sort of like issues with Europe as such. I mean, I definitely think it's a stretch to I'm not an Asiaphobe by any stretch of the imagination. I'm a Sinophile, but so on. But it's definitely a stretch to call it to call Russia sort of an Asiatic country, or let alone its politics influenced by China. There was basically no political interaction with between China and Russia until late Tsarist period, essentially. Apart from like a few treaties, but there was very minor affairs in terms of like political influence. It was mostly Byzantine influence and various reforms that were observed in Western Europe and carried over to Russia, especially during the Peter the Great era and so forth. That's one thing I'd point out. The other thing is that you do have issue with the East Europeans calling Russia Asiatic and so forth. I mean, it's pretty funny because some of the most enthusiastic people who at that the Poles uh, who uh, whose nobility believed themselves to be Sarmatians. I mean, you can literally look this up, Sarmatianism. Their nobility literally believed themselves to be like Turkic nomads who were ruling over inferior Slavic peasants. That was back during the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth. And so when these people are going to give us lectures about how Asiatic we are, that's pretty funny. I mean, probably the most accurate model of Russia is a country that's sort of like on the periphery of the West, sort of but plans of its own indigenous influences. So I suppose something like Latin America, for instance, could be one comparison, I suppose, in that respect.
Well, Russia's like, it's an open plain, right? So there certainly has been, some admixture over like thousands and thousands of years. It's kind of followed a bit of a different path, but I don't think it's really down to the physical boundaries. It's not that far from Eastern Europe, or it's not that far from Western Europe, to be honest, if you look at it sort of like a global map. But I think that there are more ideological boundaries that have sort of caused Russia to kind of go off in its own direction. I mean, one of them that you could point out is that Russia never underwent the Renaissance, which was a colossal shift in European history. And then as well, there was no Reformation in Russia. So, I mean, these are two very, very big sort of big moves towards, I guess you could say, liberalism, but it's kind of wider than that, but towards modernity, shall we say. Whereas Russia, being Orthodox, is kind of it's taken its own spiritual path. It's taken its own ideological path. For us in the West, I mean, most people who are engaged in politics have a pretty good grasp of the political implications of Catholicism, pretty good implications of the political implications of Protestantism. But Orthodoxy is a bit of a, it's a bit of a sphinx. Like, we don't quite understand what the implications of that are. So it might be good to get your take on how Orthodoxy kind of like figures into Russian politics and Russian culture more generally. Obviously, it's a huge part of it, but as far as is it a really motive force in Russian politics? Does the Orthodox Church have a lot of influence, or do you see that as being something that's sort of like dwindling and not really that much of a thing anymore?
I wouldn't exaggerate the role of religion in general, because, I mean, most of the world is secular, and, I mean, the fact that Russia didn't undergo the Reformation, it's sort of like a tautological issue. It was a inter-Catholic dispute basically resulted in the emergence of another branch of Christianity, or heresy, I mean, from another perspective, like however you want to look at it. So probably not too relevant, essentially, to the Orthodox world. I mean, today Russia is a secular country politically. I mean, obviously the church enjoys political influence and a measure of respect from society as well, and from the state. There's been a lot of church construction in the Putin era. So a lot of the churches that existed in Russia were blown up during the early Bolshevik period, or converted into storehouses and fell into decay. And a lot of those historical buildings were restored. And as regards to religiosity, I mean, I wouldn't say that Russia is an extremely very religious country. Say if you're looking at Europe, then really probably the only really religious country that remains there is Poland, more or less, and that's the only clue for the older generations there. I mean, the younger Poles are much more religious. In Russia, I mean, it varies. There's geographical differences. People in the south are more religious on average than in the north. But I wouldn't say that it plays a very big role in everyday life, like I imagine it does in the Muslim world or it used to do in the U.S. Bible Belt, although the U.S. is also rapidly secularizing, like for the past 20 years. So that sort of influence is falling quite rapidly there as well, as I understand.
I'm curious to ask you as well how you see the future, because my view is that I don't really trust in the American ruling class's capacity to adapt its the excesses of its ideology and its political systems to actually winning the Second Cold War. If you're gonna accept that the Second Cold War has already begun, I think it has. You know, you mentioned you're a Sinophile. I mean, I'm not a huge fan of like Chinese people, because I'm from Sydney, Australia, and I grew up around many Chinese people, and I don't really like them as a people that much in terms of their personality, I guess, and their culture. But I do admire greatly their state, and I think President Xi would have to be probably the most admirable statesman on the planet today, perhaps in terms of just like sheer competence. And obviously, you know, the Chinese political system has had a lot of demonstrable success. People can cope all they want, post videos about, you know, a few bridges falling down and say this means that like the Chinese economy is a paper tiger or something. But I mean, it really isn't up for debate in terms of like the economic strength of China, and also the projection that it's just going to keep expanding more and more. The United States has not met a peer economic competitor since it became, you know, a major world power in the late 19th, early 20th century, let alone a power that's looking set to basically double American economic capacity probably within our lifetimes. So I just don't see a capacity for the Americans to kind of pull everything together. It's essentially, I think Michael Hudson makes the point that Americans like to have this idea, or kind of free market ideologues have this idea that centrally planned economies always fail, and we have a free market or something. But the reality is that you can kind of have your economy planned to an extent by the state, or you know, by like, you know, basically the choice America has is you can plan it in Washington or you can plan it on Wall Street, and basically right now it's being planned on Wall Street. So basically you have like what you can call the fire economy, you know, finance, insurance, real estate. The US economy is just built out of financialization. It's built out of bidding up assets that already exist, not building new stuff, where in China, entire economy is geared towards building new stuff. So as you yourself mentioned earlier, you know, economic power gets translated into military power. And so if China can kind of, I was watching a video recently actually describing how if you kind of make adjustments to how the Chinese calculate their military spending and how the Americans calculate it, because for example, in American military spending figures, they add like the health plans of the entire US military, which is like $50 billion or something. Whereas in China, you have like state healthcare, so they don't need to give special health plans to their military. So is it really fair to say that $50 billion is really relevant to anything that the Americans spend? I wouldn't say so. So if you also make adjustments for purchasing power parity, like the dudes that are working in the factories, or even like the actual military themselves, they don't need to get paid as much in China as they do in the American military and the American military industrial complex. So China's getting more bang for its buck, essentially. Because cheap cost of living is just cheaper there in general in comparison to the United States. So if you adjust it, you can basically make the argument that basically the US and China are at parity in military spending now in real terms. And that's obviously only going to keep increasing in favor of the Chinese as things go forward. And so it will take them some time to catch up, obviously, to like the full capabilities of the United States. And they don't have anywhere near as much experience. I mean, the last time the Chinese actually had a proper war was getting their asses whooped by the Vietnamese in the late 80s, I believe. So, you know, there'll probably be some growing pains and some operational failures when they, in their first attempts at actually going to war, considering that they have zero experience. But ultimately, you would expect them to eventually translate that economic power into military power. Meanwhile, the United States, obviously, the ideological kind of self-sabotage of their military is like well documented. No one really needs to be that explained to them. So I just don't really see, you know, in the same way that in the Cold War, you know, the Americans obviously and the Soviets didn't really fire a shot at each other, but just through competitive statecraft, competitive management of the political system, eventually the Soviet system crumbled and the American system prevailed. I would expect something like the opposite to happen this time around, where the Americans essentially lose the capacity to control all of their satellites due to just the pressure that gets put on them by their opponents and crumbling under it. And you would start to see defections from, you know, other states within America's sphere of influence, and therefore the crumbling of American global power. And, you know, it's hard to predict what would happen in American domestic politics, but just that it would be sidelined in Europe and in maybe even in East Asia. And so do you agree with that assessment, number one? And number two, how do you see a future, therefore, for the Russians? Because obviously the Russians have kind of been forced to become quite dependent upon the Chinese as the kind of senior partner in their alliance due to like relative economic strength and relative population size. But a kind of Europe that is kind of liberated, if you will, from the yoke of the American imperial soft occupation. Do you see Russia essentially defecting from its relationship with the Chinese and moving into a close partnership with a post-American Europe and forming a kind of a kind of east-west kind of divide on the Eurasian continent of sorts, as the kind of like potential future geopolitical fault line? Or is that kind of too far ahead to be making those kinds of assessments? Because obviously there isn't really any other partners to turn to in the world, I guess, for, you know, let's say the Germans and the French or whatever becomes of a post-American Europe and the Russians, but one another, if they were going to kind of counter the kind of the incredible strength that the Chinese can muster within their own state.
Yes, I mean, I agree with most of that. I mean, basic demographics and HBD considerations basically imply that that the Chinese economy will be 2 to 3 times as big as the American economy in gross terms by the middle of the century or so. And yes, as you correctly pointed out, the purchasing power parity adjustments and also the greater share of procurement in the Chinese military budget implies that they're frankly already spending more on procurement in parity purchasing power adjusted terms than the US. So they're basically adding the equivalent of a great power European Navy to the People's Liberation Army Navy every single year, according to the statistics, I mean, in terms of mega tonnage. Yes, I mean, I'm not as black-pilled about as on American economic prospects as perhaps you are. I mean, obviously there's problems, but you do have many, many success stories. And I mean, if anything, if there's actually like a region of the world that's doing badly in economic terms, in terms of like relative GDP, then it's probably sooner Europe actually than the US. I mean, I don't know if the US can continue, but it does have a lot of successful startups. Even space, like all of big tech is in the US, or all the big tech that matters at the global level. And like even in terms of like new developments, there's SpaceX is doing very impressive things, and Europe frankly doesn't have anything like that. Will it continue in the US? I don't know. One problem is the sort of Obviously, woke capital, as some people discuss, basically breakdown of meritocratic appointment practices. So will the US be able to maintain its sort of like competitive edge given these sort of like ideological developments? Well, I mean, I'm not very sure of that, but I guess we'll see. And I suppose that sort of brings one to another advantage of the sort of like separations on the West is that because all this woke stuff is going to be associated with a bloc that is increasingly viewed as a geopolitical enemy of Russia, that is also obviously going to discredit its sort of internal champions within Russia. So like the liberal pro-Western opposition, essentially. So from that perspective, I mean, like assuming that wokeism, SJWism are bad things that sort of like have a deleterious effect on national cohesion and competitiveness, that is sooner a good thing than a bad thing. So this basically sundering of Russia from the West. You ask, will a post-American Europe drift closer to Russia and like form their own bloc apart from some like together with China and US? Well, I mean, that's more of a questionable, I think, assertion. I mean, ultimately, it depends a lot on the Europeans themselves. They have never exhibited any real desire to be independent from the US. They're very low energy people in general. So I mean, at least the Americans, I mean, I somewhat admire the Americans because I mean, at least they're doing fun, interesting stuff like crypto and Tesla and SpaceX and cool stuff like that. I mean, what are the equivalents in Europe? You don't have to, like when Musk sent the Tesla into space, the Europeans were whining about carbon costs or whatever crap they're interested in. So I mean, Germany spent $500 billion on renewable energy and is now suffering blackouts because now it decided to cut gas imports from Russia in addition to closing all its nuclear power plants. I mean, these are not serious people, the Europeans. I'm very skeptical that they'll like be able to do anything interesting. They have no capacity for strategic like thinking, essentially.
But do you think that is just down to like Europe being decrepit, or do you think it's down to the subversion of European political leadership by essentially American-led forces in politics, and like particularly what the essentially like financial elites kind of like rubbish politics that they're funding into existence in Europe? Or at least in the United States, they have a kind of imperial aspect to their political apparatus. They still have a kind of mythos, I guess, of like the kind of technological innovation and like, you know, great man theory is strong with the kind of Anglo heritage. So there's still like a certain resilience, I guess, in the United States system to kind of put up with this kind of ideological class. Whereas like in Europe, obviously it hasn't, they just simply have been defeated. But you know, if they're no longer occupied by the Americans, could there be, do you not have any hope that there could be a kind of restorative political movements could gain traction, more kind of like, let's say, nationalist type?
Maybe. I mean, I'm pretty agnostic on this. I mean, Orban has done very well in the recent elections, although Hungary isn't exactly like a very, very central country within the EU. I mean, Le Pen, interestingly enough, is polling very close to Macron, so who knows? I mean, the polls still do suggest that Macron is going to lose, to win, sorry, but I mean, it's going to be a closer race than last time. So, and there might be surprises. I mean, at the end of the day, I'm not a European political expert, so I can only speculate about what's going to happen. I don't really have any insight on what's going to happen there. In the meantime, I don't think that Russia itself is in any kind of hurry. Russia has very limited influence over what it can do and whether it's even like advisable to try to do anything with like to influence Europe's direction. If anything, that that's going to backfire, probably will sooner backfire than anything else. Well, I mean, my sort of approach would be to let the Europeans sort out their sort of priorities and like internal politics, and then go from there. Because I don't think the issues that Russia are facing are very urgent right now. It's the Europeans have decided to impose these massive sanctions on Russia. So it's not as if it's sort of like in a position to be choosing anyway. As regards the partnership with China, I mean, I think it makes sense because, again, Russia has been de facto locked out of Western technological cycles. And really, the only replacements for a lot of the technologies that Russia doesn't have access to will indeed come from China, especially microchips. So it's not as if this is a relationship that can or should be aborted. Other relationships should be pursued as well to the extent possible with India. I mean, India is friendly as well with South Korea, maybe perhaps with the Middle East. But at the end of the day, China is the only one of these countries that is both big and sort of like has a broad technological base, unlike India. It's a very important partner, whether you like it or not. The other thing I would point out, though, is that I don't think it's very realistic to project that this will translate into undue Chinese influence over Russia, like some people are fear-mongering. Even a country like North Korea, which is 25 million people, and basically relies on China for grain imports and subsidies. I mean, the Chinese haven't even been able to influence North Korean politics. And Australia is more dependent for export revenue on China than is Russia in relative terms. So like coal, aluminium exports are a big part of Australia's export profile, and the great bulk of it is with China. And again, Australia is a country of 25 million people, but does this translate into Chinese political control over Australia? No, it doesn't. I mean, Australia is the country like part of an anti-Chinese alliance with the US in the West Pacific. Did Russian economic penetration of Ukraine result in like a pro-Russian Ukraine? Well, no, if anything, the opposite. This sort of like model where economic penetration and influence, which is going to be necessarily quite modest between Russia and China anyway, because I mean Russia is a large country in its own right. But like even that aside, in general, I think people overstate the extent to which geopolitical like economic penetration is convertible into geopolitical influence.
Yeah, no, that's definitely a good point. I was thinking more in terms of like just China's capacity to kind of convert that economic power into like, more like hard power, let's say. And not in like the short term, but maybe in like the medium to long term, developing, essentially like if they were to develop, military alliances in Central Asia and started trying to kind of dominate that region and, project force into that region, whether that would kind of conflict with, medium to long-term, Russian interests. Obviously Russia's got, its good relations with the Syrians and reasonably good relations with the Iranians and so forth. And then obviously the kind of former Soviet republics, the stands, if you will. Obviously there's maybe a fault line there, like down the track for like a geopolitical competition, particularly if like the West is completely out of Europe and the Middle East, or at least the Americans are out of Europe and the Middle East due to some kind of contraction of their sphere of influence. But yeah, obviously we're kind of like projecting a long way into the future here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the Chinese have like historically not really been very imperial. At least, obviously there's an imperial China, but in terms of expansionism, it's just not really in them. I mean, obviously they're doing things in Africa now, and you know, it's been a long time since they've been able to basically assert themselves the way that they can today. But that historically they've just, it's just not in them to be expansionist the way that the sort of the West has been for quite some time now. But
potentially, yeah. But if the Americans are to leave the Middle East, and essentially the Middle East becomes destabilized, because I mean there's a lot of different interests there. You know, it is feasible that the Chinese will feel, well, if we don't do anything, who's really in a position to kind of provide security to that region? Maybe only the Russians are in the position to do that potentially at that point. And so do we want to like allow the Russians to gain influence and basically kind of become like a kind of dominant security partner in this region, you know, by essentially like backing the winners of that conflict? Or do we want to come in and back the winners? Because obviously, you know, the kind of China is dependent upon importing oil. And it definitely likes to buy oil from, you know, the Iranians and the Saudis and so forth. So it has obviously a kind of an interest in the region.
Oh yeah, absolutely. But I mean, like, in the past, what the way that China sort of more dealt with those kind of things is to secure its own borders and basically to, you know, dominate its sphere of influence or whatever it chooses to encompass in terms of like economics and trade and things like that. So obviously, like, you know, that can't be the only aspect of its security profile. It's going to have to assert hard power at some stage. It's going to have to assert it outside of its own borders. But it seems likely to me that China will probably opt for more sort of like economic warfare approach, which, I mean, frankly, is kind of like more the way that warfare kind of exists now. I mean, you can obviously see what's going on with sanctions in the U.S. and Russia and stuff. So that kind of seems more likely to me that they would do that. But obviously, it'll have to be a mixture of hard and soft power.
But yeah, anyway, I mean, this was a pretty great conversation. Maybe it's kind of coming to a close, but it was nice to get a perspective of, you know, a Russian on who kind of can speak English quite well and kind of understands, you know, our kind of corner of the internet on these subjects. But I guess like maybe to kind of close this off, to kind of bring it back to the topic at the beginning, you know, if you had to, and I'll put it on the spot here, but if you had to make a prediction about how the war in Ukraine goes, number one, do you think the Russians will end up, like, do you think you guys will end up like actually mobilizing and sending in like way more troops than are currently in there? And number two, you know, what do you think, like if you had to kind of bet on an outcome, what do you think you know, the outcome would be?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, the additional reservists are being volunteers are being taken in much greater numbers. So I mean, the recruitment officers were telling volunteers they weren't needed a few weeks ago, and now to the contrary, they are sort of like accepting reservist people who already have military training. So I mean, obviously they've started taking the manpower issue seriously, because yeah, I mean, the problem is that the general problem with this operation is that there was not enough manpower at the start. I mean, it was predicated on a quick victory, and in the end what happened is that like there were too many axes opened with far too many with not enough mass behind them, so the Ukrainians could stay behind and attack supply lines and so forth. So you actually need manpower, not so much to do the fighting, but just to protect convoy routes and secure towns and cities. So yeah, I mean, that's going to happen. That is already pretty much happening. Yes, as regards the final sort of like boundaries, well, I mean, what I initially thought would take several weeks is going to take several months. But otherwise, I don't really see any pressing need to change my predictions. I mean, if anything, the fact that the sanctions are extreme and already locked in, if anything, that sort of like reinforces the maximalist interpretation. So I mean, what I would expect, I would certainly be very surprised if there's a long term ceasefire without at least Novorossiya coming under Russian control. So as the 8 oblasts of southern and eastern Ukraine. And I think there's a more than 50% chance that this includes all of the lands east of the Dnieper in general, and probably maybe 50 or 40% chance that it goes all the way to the 1939 border. So that's around Zhytomyr and Vinnytsia. So that's sort of my standing prediction from the first day of the conflict. And since then, I haven't really seen anything that has made me want to drastically revise those assessments.
What do you think about the Transnistrians in Moldova? Do you think they link up with them and try to integrate them into this Nova Russian state?
Well, I mean, if and when Odessa is taken, there will be a direct land connection to Transnistria. And at that point, it probably wouldn't make much sense not to do that. Well, I mean, at least to the extent that that relations with Moldova and Romania go forwards. But I mean, frankly, I consider Moldova to basically, I mean, what are Moldovans? They're basically Romanians who spent two centuries under Russian control. So I don't really see any sort of very good reason for Moldova to exist as a state, the poorest state in Europe. They're basically Romanians at the end of the day. Probably the logical sort of solution to that would simply be to have Moldova go into Romania and Transnistria go into Russia.
And do you think the Hungarians or the Poles might try and snap off pieces of Western Ukraine that they have historical claims to? Or do you think that's just not politically feasible because the West will want to create a moral high ground or whatever?
Well, yeah, I mean, I don't think the Poles would go for that because they're sort of too deep within the Western nimplex on this issue. Frankly, there's no Poles at this time anyway in Galicia. They were ethnically cleansed during World War II because of the actions of certain people, Ukrainians, who are now national heroes in Ukraine. So that's an amusing fact that should Russia lose in Ukraine, those sort of issues between Poland and Ukraine will arise because they view Bandera and Shurevich as their national heroes, and the Poles are view them as the butchers of Volyn. But yeah, I mean, that's sort of an aside. I don't think the Poles will do that. I mean, but the Hungarians might, because there is a Hungarian minority in Zakarpattia, and Orban has been making some noises about coming to their aid. So who knows? I mean, obviously, the NATO and the EU probably aren't going to be very happy about that. So I mean, I guess it sort of depends on the political conjuncture.
Okay, well, thanks for coming on. Mike, do you have anything to say about Imperium Press related stuff while we're kind of in a podcast?
Yeah, so we are going to be having a major release drop at the end of next week. Depends when this gets released, but basically on Friday the 15th, it's going to come out. It's going to be pretty big. I think it's going to fill a gap in our catalog that has been void since we delisted Nemesis, So yeah, get excited for new product. It's coming out. Guys are going to really like it. So we'll say a little bit more about that next week and kind of ramp it up as it goes. Other than that, follow the Imperium Press YouTube channel that's been launched. We've got two videos on there now, and there's going to be quite a few coming. So yeah, definitely go there and subscribe to it. It's going to be it'll be different stuff than what you're seeing on Joel's channel, which is obviously excellent content, but we're going to be doing different stuff more related to the books and whatnot. Maybe a couple of interviews, and there will be a surprise announcement as well coming up later this month, a new podcast that we're going to be doing. It'll be myself and Dave Martell. So we're going to be doing something kind of cool, I think. And of course, continuing on with the Imperium cast. So that's what's new with us. Definitely go and subscribe to the YouTube channel.